Okay, I've got my guest, Vicki Davis, on the line. You there, Vicki?
Yes, I am.
Okay, well, I'm going to go ahead and say that, this is Truth Quest with Melody, and this is KHENLPFM Radio 106.9 Salida, and we're streamed on the internet at KHEN.org. And Truth Quest programs are archived at www.givemesometruth.info. And I've had Vicki Davis on a number of times. She's a researcher and has a website at channelingreality.com, correct?
Is that right? Yes, that's correct.
Okay, and she is just a wealth of information. She's one of those people that will dig into stuff that some of us would never consider. Some of us do, but a lot of people wouldn't. but tonight is she's got a subject that I truly feel is real important, and I kind of saw it coming, but I didn't realize how it would come. But they're called free trade zones, and I'm going to let her take it from there because she's the one that's done all the research, and I just kind of, you know, watch as she just, you know, throws out the information that she's digging up. So,
yeah. Well, actually, it's called a foreign trade zone. And in some countries, like China, I think they call them free trade zones over there. But which is one of the difficulties about researching this is that the same entity is described with different names in different places. And so you have to kind of, look at what the structure is and then research it from the definition of the structure rather than the name, which is always kind of an interesting exercise.
Well, kind of like certain terms where you'll see one place, you know, democracy termed is socialism in another place or different words are, you know, interchanged back and forth, and so it does get kind of confusing, or liberal or progressive or whatever, and then you find out later on down the road when somebody was accusing me of being one way or the other, and I'm going, huh? Because they had a different meaning for the same idea, but when you're thinking it's one thing and they're thinking it's another, it gets kind of confusing for you.
Yeah, I have a friend who would call that the Tower of Babel. Same words, but different definitions. And so, you know, people talk past each other. But what this subject is about is that last May, I read an article in the Idaho Statesman, their online version, about a 23-person delegation from Guangzhou. I'm sure I just massacred that name. It's a province in China, and they were coming to Meridian, Idaho for a visit. And the purpose of their visit was to tour an area that's called the Core. And the article described the Core as being a local healthcare, technology, and industry-related growth corridor. And the businesses involved would be the new Idaho State Meridian Health Science Center, St. Luke's Meridian Medical Center, Boise State University, and the area high schools. And then down the last line in the article, it said, Chinese businessmen investing $1 million for 5 years in American ventures are eligible to obtain visas granting them permanent status in the United States. So, and I knew what that meant. That meant EB-5 visas, you know, which are basically allowing foreigners to buy American citizenship, you know, and there is a price. In a rural area, it's $500,000. In a more urban area, it's $1 million, you know, so, you know, they're just kind of selling our country there. So what I did is I called the city of Meridian, which is an unusual thing for me. Normally I don't do that kind of
investigating.
yeah, on the ground investigating. I just rely on the internet. But in this case, I thought it was important enough, and I wanted to hear from somebody in Meridian what this thing was about. So I spoke with a woman named Brenda Sherwood, who is the Meridian Economic Development Specialist. And what she told me was that the Corps was called the Corps because it's in a transportation corridor, that it was an EB-5 regional center, and the regional center is a 501c6 organization.
Okay, wait a minute. Now, EB-5 standing, do you have an idea what that stands for?
It's employment-based visa.
Okay.
Let's see if I scroll down here. Yeah, it's the EB-5 visas are reserved for targeted employment areas. And
so if they're like low in certain types of employees, they want to import certain types of employees, they would come under these kind of visas. Is that
No, what they did is they defined this kind of visa as being available for areas that have a certain level of unemployment over a period of time.
Okay.
So
I think that was kind of what I was aiming at, but I didn't state it right.
Uh-huh. Yeah, so they the idea supposedly is that it will bring investment dollars into an area that is underutilized, you might say, or, you know, where there's a lot of unemployment.
Okay.
And it turned out that the entire state of Idaho,
fits.
Is designated as a targeted employment area, you know. And Butch Otter, the governor of Idaho, he had a plan that is associated with the Corps. The name of his plan is Project 60, and the plan was to grow the state's annual gross domestic product from $52 billion to $60 billion. So, you know, he's planning on attracting $8 billion worth of foreign direct investment into the state of Idaho. Okay, but at this point, you know, where I was researching the Corps, one of the things that this Sherwood woman told me was that they were considering making it a foreign trade zone, but that they hadn't decided yet. So, you know, pretty much all of the entities that, I mean, this is really quite a complex scheme they have going on here. And I knew parts of it. I knew about the intermodal commerce zones, for example, that occur at transportation hubs. I knew about the EB-5 visa program. It was a surprise to me to find out that the entire state of Idaho was an EB-5 zone, a T-zone, if you will. So it took me, you know, quite a while to figure out, you know, how in the world am I going to explain all of this to people, because part of this involves the education system as well. And in that first paragraph that I was reading to you, where the universities and the schools are involved, that involves, you know, work-based learning, which is part of the redesign of the schools. So they've got this whole complex structure going on here, and I've spent probably a good 3 months, you know, researching it and writing about the various aspects of it, to try and explain the whole structure to people. And it wasn't easy, and I'm not sure even still, you know, that that I was able to do that. But the important parts of it, as it turns out, have come out and have been exposed. Most recently, when somebody, well, Bernadine of the Second Amendment Foundation,
Bernadine Smith.
Yeah, Bernadine Smith got one of the emails about the zone, and she sent out an email, and boy, it has just taken off. You know, everybody is interested in finding out about the foreign trade zones, and so that just kind of expanded the story. You know, it's just been kind of mushrooming. It's fabulous that, you know, this.
And people are starting to get it because they kind of understand that you know what's behind it. Even though it took you a while to find all the little tentacles that and I'm sure you haven't uncovered them all yet. But
oh, I'm sure. I'm just sure of that because it is quite a complex and very strategically designed thing that they did here. And I do believe that it was strategically designed. I don't think there was anything about this system that was accidental or coincidental.
Well, let me ask you a couple of things first. Often you hear, you know, doing research off the internet, that the internet is, you know, such a supposedly
unreliable.
Unreliable, yes. But do you believe that?
If you don't know what you're looking at, if you just walk up to a machine and do a search on Google, yes, I would say that if you don't know what you're doing, then you can't rely on the information that you find. If, however, you are an experienced researcher and you know how to determine, you know what websites you're looking at, first of all, and even if you do look at one of the alternative or, you know, many of the alternative websites, if you then know how to verify the information on the credible websites, the internet is just the most awesome tool ever invented, you know, for doing research.
Right, right. And, you know, and even I've found even when you look in books or you go to verify certain things. I mean, I went to a courthouse in the last year and found out the courthouses, there's a lot of room for error there. And it's passed off as, being this verifiable information. And I found out, hey, wait a minute, you got to verify everything.
Yeah. Well, people are human, and people make mistakes, and when you're researching something like these zones that I ended up calling it a Trojan Triangle because I needed to give it a name because there were so many pieces to it that it would take me, you know, a full paragraph to just describe all of the pieces to it. And so I had to give it a name for the entire structure of it. So I called it a Trojan Triangle. And when you're researching something like this, there are so many pieces to it and so much information that you go through. And not everybody's understanding of things are on the same level.
Right.
I mean, when I go back in my website and I look at things that I wrote maybe 3 or 4 years ago, I see where I had maybe a partial understanding. And, you know, while I wasn't wrong in what I was saying, I may not have been entirely correct either because I didn't present the bigger picture or the context as fully as what I could do now,
right.
Put it that way.
Right. So, I guess where I was going to go with my next question is the fact that being able to, I mean, what significance would these things mean? And in order to do that, you got to kind of understand the overall picture of where, you know, what's being involved and where it's been and where it's going. And a lot of people would just, you know, roll their eyes and go, you know, where would you come up with all of this? But when you start reading some of the works and some of us that, you know, not everybody can do all the research. So sometimes it really helps having a network of people that can go to someone that can kind of direct you in the right directions and start knowing where to look or come up with some of the answers, right?
Yeah. Well, and in my case with this, I mean, I can't even say where my beginning point was, it perhaps with the education system, because I'm a computer systems analyst. And so, you know, when I found out about the National Human Resource Management System that the governor, or not the governor, the government was designing, I researched that because I was so stunned that such an un-American system was being installed in our country. And I you know, I don't want to go off onto a tangent and describe
yeah, but,
that.
But see, yeah, but resource, man, I mean, this is where being able to take little tidbits here and there and start putting the pieces together of the puzzle, even though sometimes you don't always have an idea exactly where it's all going to lead. You're just taking little bits and facts and putting them out there and then, you know, starting to see an overall picture, correct?
Yeah. Well, and a friend of mine who has been following my research for quite a long time, he said to me one time, he said, this is like a 1,000-piece puzzle. And, you know, you put a piece in at a time, and, you know, sometimes you find the one key piece that, you know, just makes the whole picture visible. And these Trojan triangles actually did that. But, okay, so the education system was something that I'd researched, and the NAFTA superhighway is that the research that I did on that, when the whole thing about the North American Union became public and people were starting to talk about that, in the media, they were denying that there ever was such a thing called the NAFTA superhighway. And there were people saying, oh, it's a conspiracy theory. And even Vice President Dick Cheney said, oh, it's a conspiracy theory. Well, you know, there were several of us that worked on pulling the history together. And one of the things that I looked at, I spent quite a long time looking at, was the Intermodal Surface Transportation Efficiency Act of 1991. You know, it's really kind of a funny thing, a bizarre thing that, you know, a person would sit down and read transportation legislation that was 15 years old, but I did it. And
this is where I'm saying this is where you're best.
The whole, what they did is they declared the Dwight David Eisenhower interstate highway system as complete, and they defined a new highway system around the concept of intermodalism. And intermodalism is when two modes of now this is for commercial transport of anything, you know, whether you're shipping things or whether you're doing passengers or airplanes or whatever, planes, trains, automobiles, all that. But when two modes of transportation come together at the same point so that you can do transfer transportation from one mode to another in the same trip. Now, that's an important concept.
So is that like going from ship to truck?
Right.
Okay.
Exactly, yeah. Ship shipped to the train or shipped to a truck or whatever, but it's all part of the same trip. That is an intermodal trip, and the transfers occur at the transportation hubs that they defined as being the intermodal zones. Okay. Now, those zones had to be defined in state law, at least in Idaho. It's Title 70, Chapter 22. And essentially, what they did is, oh, and another thing that they did is that they included all arterials to and from the transportation hubs to the major cities. So, essentially, they nationalized our entire system of transportation, all the roads.
And they weren't, so all roads weren't nationalized before then? Or
no, Okay. No, they were not federal. The only ones that were federal were the
interstate. Okay.
Now, there were U.S. highways, and I'm not sure what the history on those were, but the interstate, for sure, was federal, and it was called the Dwight David Eisenhower Defense Highway System. But the ICE-T legislation of 1991 declared that as complete. In 1995, they did a lot of things in that legislation. That was just one of them. But in 1995, they had, I should back up and explain to you about the corridors. In the ICE-T legislation, they also defined the highways as being corridors. And that's an important concept, too, for what follows to the Trojan Triangles. But a corridor is not just a highway. A corridor is all things that go in a line that are part of the transportation system. So that would include your highways, your truck lanes, your trains, pipelines, fiber optic cable, everything that goes in a line that could be considered as part of this linear corridor system.
There's got to be a little more to that, because you're starting to see that terminology used in everything. When I drive on the highway now, I see safety corridor, I see wildlife corridor, I see that term corridor used for so many different things, even though I know what you're saying, that it's all things that align, but I'm wondering, why are they encompassing so many different areas? Is it to the point that it's going to mean anything?
Well, it means a lot. It's probably one of the most important concepts that everybody needs to learn is a corridor. And you can just visualize it as being, linear and for a specific designated purpose.
Okay.
The transportation corridors aren't just, as I said, aren't just for transportation, but it serves as a convenient route for pipelines, for example. Because with your highways you get the right of way, and so it serves a convenient purpose for pipelines. But another thing that the intermodal, the ICE-T legislation of 1991 called for is smart highways, meaning computer technology totally integrated into the transportation system. And so that means, the fiber optic cable, it means sensors, it means data collection points, it means satellite, all of those things integrated into the transportation system.
Okay, because we have right in through our particular area, we have what they call a utility corridor.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Probably for transmission lines, right?
Well, it could, just like you said, it could be, transmission lines or, and they've got phone, they've got railroad, they've got highway, river, it seems to be kind of it could be an all-encompassing idea of what it, utility means.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, that's interesting because I wouldn't define a utility corridor as being one that would be available to the public to use, but maybe that could be something unique to Colorado, which here again goes back to the difficulty of researching all of this is that states tend to define things the way that they want to within certain parameters. The underlying definition of what they're describing is the same because I think they use model legislation, and I honestly wonder if our legislators actually ever write anything except these dumb little memorials. But
well, it seems like a lot of the think tanks, that's what they're kind of designed to do, is it kind of write the legislation, and then the politicians just kind of have to go along with whatever's put before them and don't even read it, but they can vote on it.
Yeah. Well, that's kind of what it seems like.
Not that they're given the opportunity to necessarily read it either. I mean, when you have 1,000-page documents that's full of so much, stuff that doesn't even necessarily pertain to, what you think would pertain to the legislation that they think they're voting on.
Yeah. Well, they don't do it. They aren't as bad about that at the state level, at least not in Idaho. But they do give those guys the bum's rush. They get buried in all kinds of bills, and then it's just, vote this, vote this, vote this. And so basically the party apparatus are the ones that are controlling what goes in. And they do it through the leadership. But I mean, once you understand what's going on, you can see that the activities going on in your state house are designed just, it's kind of like a con game, where they rush these guys, they overload them. Mm-hmm. And then they just tell them vote this. So
okay, now, kind of give us before we get into too much on the all these extraneous things around this foreign trade zone. Let's get into what they are and how they function, and then how these other aspects of it tie in.
Okay. Well, I have to go back to the iced tea legislation and say that was designed around the idea of intermodalism. And the intermodalism is the transportation hubs, and the they're called the, in Idaho law, they're called the intermodal commerce zones. And in the Trojan Triangle, as I defined it, transportation hubs, the intermodal commerce zones, are one side of the triangle,
okay,
of the Trojan Triangle.
Okay.
So
you have your transportation system that's involved.
Right, and okay, you have the education system.
Okay.
Because that's...
Is that used as part of the faction to provide, not only to educate, but to provide the people... And a means to bring the people in with these EB-5 visas?
Well, with the EB-5 visas, the foreign investors, and it's not just the Chinese, by the way.
Okay, right. Just, I realize that. Isn't that a kind of a population that seems to be kind of prevalent in Idaho, in your area?
Yeah, I think we're being invaded, and I think it's, they're kind of like...
I mean, if you were down in Arizona, it may be from other, other nations.
Yeah, when Jane Lesko talked to some of the Customs and Border Protection people, what a joke that is, Customs and Border Protection, that's funny. But she talked to some of them down in Texas, and apparently most of the foreign trade zones down in Texas are run by Mexican companies, or, you know.
And maybe in some other places there may be some other, maybe Russian or some other other types of Indian, you know.
Right.
East
yeah,
Indian.
I think San Jose. I'm sure that this whole Trojan Triangle system is how the Indians came to take over Silicon Valley, because I read one time that the companies in Silicon Valley there were invited to a meeting by the Chamber of Commerce, and it was at, you know, an airport inn, and I'm sure that they were presented with this whole Trojan Triangle system. But how education fits into it is that that's one of the perks for businesses locating within the zone, is that the state, your state government, will customize worker training for businesses that are in the zone.
And those are ones that that are either purchased or brought in to locate in these zones, is that?
Well, they're established by either, now I'm not sure who defines what businesses go into the zone, whether it's the regional center, but I kind of suspect that they are controlling what kind of businesses. I know that they're supposed to all be just technology-based businesses. And, you know, there again, we get into another layer of complexity in this thing that we'll hold off for the moment. But
not much in the resource arena? Like, you know, like your, you know, raw resources, like, you know, minerals and things of that sort? You're not seeing it?
No, but the people coming in to the country, you know, once they pay their citizenship money, they're free to go wherever they want and buy whatever they want. They're not just limited to that much money, you know, to the $1 million investment or the $500,000 investment. And in the case of China, you know, where the Chinese businesses are actually state-owned businesses. I mean, you know, they could be sending their money people here, and, you know, they could be giving them $1 billion to spend. We don't know. They could buy up our whole damn country.
Well, you know, I mean, I think we experienced some of that, you know, back in the 70s or 80s with the Saudis, didn't we, where they were coming in and purchasing or going... Were you familiar with any of that? Or?
Well, I don't think it was the Saudis in the 70s. That was the Japanese.
Okay. Well,
that
I remember
were coming
the,
in.
Yeah, I remember the Japanese, but I thought there was a part in time when the Saudis may have been. But
well, there was Dubai. There was, okay. But that was about 5 years ago when Dubai was going to take over port management of
in ports. In you're talking about shipping ports and that sort?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. So, but I guess why there's, I mean, you'd sent me an email that had some articles on the fact that, and the Chinese are in that position because they're very, they've been, you know, getting a lot of cash and, metals and that sort, where they can turn around and buy up assets with that. And if every, you know, you have countries like ours that is, you know, the economies are starting to go down, that makes it very advantageous for them to come back in here and start purchasing.
The whole decline of our economy was engineered.
Right.
And now they're, you know, bringing the money, the businesses that that were exported from our country under these trade agreements is now in the hands of the Chinese, and they're circling back around, coming back in to buy up our country.
And you're seeing that is being very prevalent in Idaho at this point in time, although it's happening all over the country, I would imagine.
Yeah. Jane Lesko of Eagle Forum of Idaho found this article called Chinese Company Eyes Boise. And it starts out by saying that a Chinese national company is interested in developing a 10 to 30,000 acre technology zone for industry, retail, and homes south of the south of Boise Airport. Well, you know, then she and I started really looking at this, and you know, she really dug into the foreign trade zone stuff, which I'd kind of skipped over. I had so many other things to look at that I really, when I wrote my thing on the Corps, I noted it, you know, that this woman, Brenda Sherwood, said that they were considering making it a foreign trade zone. But that's one of the things, you know, where you say, okay, well, I know what a foreign trade zone is, so I don't need to look at this. Well, wrong. That's the wrong thing to do, because even though you think you know what these things are, chances are once you start digging in to how they're defined and what the regulations are and everything, you may not really know it, even though you know the words and you know kind of what it represents, but there's a lot behind all of it.
Okay, so what is the significance of these zones? What do they mean to us?
Well, what a foreign trade zone is first of all, it's a building that exists for, well, it's an enclosed, restricted area for goods and services that are involved in international trade. And for the purposes of customs and duties, the territory within a foreign trade zone is considered foreign soil for customs purposes, meaning that any materials that arrive in the zone won't be taxed until those materials or those goods enter the United States for commercial purposes, to be sold, in other words, or whatever. So what we found out is that there are 257 foreign trade zones in the United States.
Okay, so it's kind of like piecemealing this country out to foreign entities then.
Yeah, it's kind of like segregating territory and designating it as not really part of the United States anymore.
Okay, so it's kind of like a way of colonizing the U.S. then.
Well, that's what I was thinking initially, but it's what the foreign trade zone does is that it internationalizes the airport or the transportation hub where it resides. It provides the definition of international commerce.
Okay, so and already we already have some of our airports in this country deemed international, and so that they're under the control of an international organization and not necessarily of the surrounding municipality or state. Correct?
Right. Okay. Right. And so that's where you have to start looking at the definition of port. It turns out that they define even an airport as a port. And, you know, always, you know, in my world, when I grew up, a port was on the water. So, you know, it was quite a surprise to me to find out that they had defined the Boise Airport as a port of entry.
Okay.
So you have the foreign trade zone, you have the definition of port, and you have the definition of port of entry. But I think you can have a port of entry without having the warehouse. Okay. Just means, I guess, that you can receive international flights and that you do have a customs and border patrol person that is there responsible for whatever is coming in internationally, coming in or going out internationally. But another definition that I found out about is a port district. So not only can you have the intermodal commerce zone at the transportation hub, it can be a port and a port of entry, it can also be a port district. And one interesting little factoid I just found out, the Port Authority of New York was written into law, passed into law by the Congress in 1921. And the port district, the port authority that the Port Authority reigns over in the New York, New Jersey area is about 1,500 square miles. Okay, and a port district is a political jurisdiction unto itself. It's not a city, it's not a county, it's not a state, obviously. It is a separate and distinct political subdivision in its own right.
I don't know if I'm going off in the wrong direction here, but most of us have been, you know, under the assumption that states and cities and municipalities and whatever and the political entities are the things that govern things. But it looks to me like, in all reality, because I'm finding out now that most all of those are incorporated entities, and then you're putting in these trade zones and your corridors and trade agreements, that it's all really a commercial aspect. That it, you know, we're thinking we're being run under politics, but these seem to be more of a commercial operation.
Well, I think what you could say is that, yeah, when I was growing up, I learned that the political structures in our country were that there were towns and counties and cities and states, and that was basically it. But where the real power is, that what they're doing with our government is that they are converting over to a management structure. And they are using these different definitions, different kinds of zoning, and multiple layers of zoning, and new political fictions that we wouldn't even be aware of, you know, here in the interior. It would never occur to any of us that we would have a port district. Basically, they are converting us over to a system under management, not under elected representative government.
Okay.
And so, but I guess, you know, people that live on the ocean, like in Santa Cruz, they're familiar with the idea of a port district. You know, but here in the interior of the country, it's such a foreign concept that you know, I doubt very many people, it would even occur to many people to even look at that.
So what are they building inside of these foreign trade zones? What's going on?
Well, I mean, they can actually, when foreign trade zones were first defined in 1934, they were just basically holding facilities. There was no manufacturing allowed. But as the GATT rounds, the Bretton Woods, you know, trade rounds progressed over the years, they changed the definitions over time so that now basically they can do anything in a zone that they can do outside of a zone. So from that standpoint, you know, they're integrated into the economy, but they are still a restricted area controlled by Customs and Border Patrol.
Would it be kind of like...
I call them patrol, it's protection.
But do they have kind of like immunities, like an embassy might or something?
Yeah, they... What the Customs Service says is that they have to follow all of the state and local laws that, you know, within the jurisdiction where they are, but that's kind of misleading, and it's not entirely true. If a crime is committed on foreign trade zone property, the Customs and Border Patrol makes the makes the determination of whether or not they believe that a local type crime was committed, and your local sheriff has to be invited into the area. Otherwise, you know, they can't really go in there. All they can do is request to go into the restricted area of a foreign trade zone. So the state really is giving up control of that zone, even though the feds say that they have to follow all of the laws that everybody else does.
Okay, so what constitutes them being able to make one of these zones?
They basically just have to, there has to be somebody that wants to apply for the zone management, and they have to have a warehouse, and they have to promise to have a computer system that they can tap into the Customs and Border Patrol international commerce, you know, global trade system, the world customs system.
So if you have the dollar collapse in the economy in this country just kind of go way south, then you have something like this where these guys come in to rescue the economy. Then they already have a workforce that's, you know, without work and able to support themselves, and then they may be able to be the take advantage of that situation, maybe, correct?
Well, if they want to rescue our economy, they'll just eliminate the definition of all of these foreign trade zones. They'll put tariffs on anything that comes. They'll put taxes on anything that comes into this country. And if the companies that are in the foreign trade zones don't like it, they can get the heck out. You know, the intermodal commerce zones that they've defined in Idaho, they're tax exempt, so they pulled that property and all the businesses that are in there. They've pulled that off the tax rolls.
So again, you have something that doesn't support the local structure, so that they can the local people can pool their forces and deal with it. They're coming in with some. I mean, you have a foreign entity that's coming in with what? Who knows what kind of funds that can override any local governmental entity? Is that
right? Well, and it's even worse than that, because, you know, they build a technology park or whatever in this zone. It's pulled off the tax rolls, but there's still the infrastructure that has to be built to support it, and the homeowners and taxpayers in the surrounding area, they pay for that through increases in their own property tax. So
what do you think their purpose, I mean, have you found documentation to state as to what the purpose is behind all of this?
Well, I know what I believe it to be, and in order to understand that, you have to look at what was Mexico's development plan. You have to go back to pre-2001, and Mexico had a NAFTA trade case with the United States regarding trucks coming, you know, Mexican trucks coming into the United States. Well, the United States didn't want to let Mexican trucks in because they didn't meet the same safety standards that trucks in our country did, and so we blocked them. Well, Mexico took a case to the NAFTA Kangaroo Court, and in February of 2001, the Kangaroo Court decided in Mexico's favor. September 6th. What NAFTA Chapter 11 is, that's an important provision of NAFTA to understand. If a country is found to be blocking what should be a legitimate business enterprise, and they are not allowing it, then the NAFTA tribunal can award damages that for prospective losses. So Mexico, you know, in this situation, they could say, well, you know, we've lost $4 billion because you wouldn't let us bring our ratty old trucks into your country. And the United States government would have to pay Mexico $4 billion for prohibiting Mexican businesses from making a profit on their business. I mean, it's such the most ridiculous provision that you could possibly imagine. And nobody in their right mind would ever agree to a contract provision like that. But the U.S. trade negotiators did. And so that's one of the reasons why I say that our economy, they made war on our economy, and they did it through administrative means. And the NAFTA agreement, and in particular NAFTA Chapter 11, is one way that they did that.
So in other words, you know, instead of being invaded from outside, we're being taken down from inside, and it's through these foreign trade agreements is one method of doing it.
Yeah. If I had my way, if I could do something about this, I would put every single U.S. trade representative that is living today, I would put them on trial for treason.
Okay, now one of the things I pulled up, I'm looking here on the internet, and I looked up these foreign trade zones, and then they had a thing that you could go in here and check them out by state, and there happened to be two in Colorado. But one of the things that I did see that, you know, you had like storage technology, Artisan Technologies, then Eastman Kodak Company, and this was for a place in Denver, and this is under the something called a subzone. Are you familiar with that? What that is?
Yeah, each foreign trade zone can have any number of subzones, and a subzone is defined when either, you know, for space or just the logistics or the type of business being located in the subzone, it doesn't fit within the perimeter or adjacent to a foreign trade zone. So they can have an area that is far away designated as a subzone of the foreign trade zone.
Okay, now this is my mind working here, but let me go, before I get into that, let me just say the views and expressed on this program are those of myself and of my guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the KHEN staff, volunteers, or board of directors, and this is KHENLP 106.9 Salida, and this is Truth Quest with Melody, and my guest is Vicki Davis, and we're talking about foreign trade zones. But when I'm looking here at subzones, I'm looking at some rather major corporate names like Walmart, Intel, Conair, Abbott, PetSmart, Microchip, you know, technology, things like this, Sanyo, you know, L'Oreal, Husqvarna, things like this. And I'm going, now, maybe I'm way out to lunch here, but it makes me wonder if a lot of these companies that left this country are coming back in via these subzones and getting some of the benefits of what these comes with the foreign trade zones.
That's perfectly possible, that they're coming back in and doing their business on a foreign trade zone, you know, and taking advantage of the infrastructure here. But then exporting, and that's another one of the pieces that I wrote was that it seems like what the globalist banker psychopaths have set up is what I called a crisscross double cross, meaning that they get American businesses to do foreign direct investment in China. And they get China to turn around and do foreign direct investment into the United States. Economically, that makes no sense whatsoever.
Except if you're trying to bring a country down economically.
Yes, that's true. That's true. When they started exporting businesses from the United States and they eliminated the prohibitions of capital leaving this country. Basically, it was like letting the air out of a balloon. But the thing is that our economy is so big that it's taken, you know, a number of years, you know, almost like two decades to bring us to the point where we're almost, you know, we're on our knees. And so now they're bringing in the communist Chinese foreign direct investment into rural areas where the people are kind of desperate. I mean, doesn't that kind of seem like a real strategic plan to you for conversion?
Oh, I saw this coming a long time ago because what I was observing taking place on a national, international level was very similar to what they do on a corporate takeover. Mm-hmm. And being in the business that I had been in, I watched so much of it, I didn't even know what company my paycheck was coming from because they were trading business names so swiftly. I couldn't keep up with it.
Yeah, well, once they, you know, after 1995, after they signed the WTO agreement and American firms and American workers, you know, the barriers all came down and, you know, we were kind of like, you know, the big fat hogs out in the field and, the corporations just basically left because if they can produce in third world countries with the cheapest labor in the entire world and then import back into this country with no penalty at all, then of course they're going to do it. You know, they would be stupid not to, and nobody ever accused them of being stupid, you know.
Yeah, but unfortunately, those that may have seen the writing on the wall and who may have objected to it eventually were forced to comply with the rest of them, or they didn't survive.
That's right.
Or they were bought up, or they were, you know, they had so many different aspects that you see taking place that they've consolidated. I mean, when I started out in my business of insurance, I mean, there was hundreds of insurance companies that no longer exist.
Yeah.
And you got down to where there was just handfuls left, just like with your media. You know, there's just a handful of media when there was tons of them out there. So
Right. And under the idea of global competitiveness, you know, it was get big or get out, which meant that, you know, they just they got rid of all of our laws against monopolies, and they just said, go to it, you know, get as big as you want.
Right, and so all the lessons that may have been learned in the past through various economic situations in the prior last century were kind of, like you said, overlooked or changed, and so now we're back into a situation where it's a lot of monopolies or pseudo-monopolies.
Basically, it was the rise of fascism. Supply-side economics is fascism. They put everything into the supply side. And, you know, I blame the British for this, the British economists and their comparative advantage, and they're going back to, you know, the 18th century economists named Ricardo, who was a socialist, by the way, and you know, they promoted this idea of free trade and comparative advantage. Well, China has the cheapest labor in the world, and they've got a population of 1.5 billion people, so they've got a comparative advantage on labor. And gee whiz, never mind that, you know, all the jobs that Americans used to do were exported over to China, and now people, the American people, can't find jobs, you know.
Yeah, so, and then in the meantime, we took up, you know, building the military and prison system, and our prison system is now what competes with the Chinese slave labor.
That's right. That's right, and all of this stuff is, I believe, pretty strategic.
Right.
You know, and that private prison system is a pretty darn good business. You know, you bring in the drugs on one side, you arrest the young people, and you've got healthy young workers in prison for, you know, 5 years or 10 years of indentured servitude. At, you know, and you're paying them 15 cents an hour, which is even really less than China, you know, because they have to pay the Chinese workers, you know, 50 cents an hour.
So ultimately, where would we find correlated efforts? I mean, this isn't just going on in this country. This is probably going on around various places of the world.
It's going on all over the world, and that brings me back to the idea that I was going to get to on the port districts. Okay, now, with that NAFTA case, the NAFTA tribunal that found in Mexico's favor, there had to be a settlement, you know, with Mexico, because we didn't allow their crummy, trashy trucks to come into the United States. Well, it turned out Mexico partnered up with APEC, which is the Asia-Pacific Economic Forum, and Mexico, Vicente Fox's development plan was that he was going to allow Hutchison Whampoa to build those ports down in the southern part of Mexico. They defined 5 or 6 inland ports throughout Mexico, and they defined a continuous land route, kind of a shipping lane, you might think of it, along the Trans-Texas Corridor clear into Kansas City with a Mexican customs office in Kansas City. Now, what that did was to bring international maritime law into the heart of the United States, right into the center. The rest of the corridor system, which they defined in transportation legislation over a period of the next, 7, 8, 9 years, something like that, they defined additional corridors and different elements of the transportation system to create what is, in effect, a system that makes the United States simply a land border between two bodies of water, meaning that they have defined the international shipping lanes throughout our country up into Canada so that freight, commercial goods can just, you know, go zipping right through our country and never enter the United States.
And see, that can go, that goes from one end of the country in this particular instance from north and south. So ultimately it's dividing the country in half. And,
yes.
And this particular NAFTA superhighway is quite wide, and there isn't a lot of places to get on and off except through designated areas. So, I mean, it's almost kind of like splitting Berlin or splitting Germany, you know, and but doing it with an economic reason behind it. So it kind of soft soaps the idea of what's taking place.
Well, and that's exactly right. You know, they, what they've done with the definition of the shipping lanes and the inland ports is that they have turned our cities into potentially, I don't think they've done it completely with Boise yet, although they're working on it, but they have turned it into an international area. Ports are international, and there is international law that governs port cities. And there are rights and privileges and benefits afforded to countries that don't have access to the water. And, you know, the way that these people work is that they start out legislation as being one thing, but they tweak it over time. It becomes something else. And so it looks to me like that it's set up in such a way that they can turn Boise, Idaho, into a center city like the city of London, or the Washington, D.C. is a district. City of London is a district. New York City is a district by virtue of the Port Authority, and that's the significance of the Port District. And I'm positive, well, I know that the Trojan Triangles are being implemented all over the world.
Okay, I'm looking at a site here right now that's called the Foreign Trade Zone Corporation, and it's a foreign trade zone specialist. And they're saying the Foreign Trade Zone Corporation is the only nationally recognized firm that limits its practice to foreign trade zone consulting. This firm has assisted in developing over 250 foreign trade zone projects and has been recognized for obtaining and implementing some of the most significant advancements in the foreign trade zones program, such as weekly entry for distribution. Now, it goes on further, but it's naming companies like Lane, Cisco, JVC as their clients, Siemens, this thing's kind of rotating through, in Tiffany, Banner, I mean, there's a Mercedes-Benz, I mean, there's all kinds of Rolls-Royce, all kinds of companies, DuPont, that are listed here. So this thing is, I mean, when they're having these global meetings, I mean, this is the kind of stuff that's getting discussed and divvied up. It's like, you know, it is no longer a you know, they don't view us as a country, but as a a commodity, and commodities built within this bounds between these ports, right?
Yeah, they're breaking up the United States and the inland port. The port districts will allow our cities to become like international city states unto themselves.
So, go ahead.
and to make it even worse, because there's a foreign trade zone there and it involves customs, then you have, it was the hook for the global systems, because you not only have the customs for your country, but there is a global customs system. And the United States, supposedly the United States, I don't really consider them part of the American government, even though there are representatives on the board of directors of this firm called ITDS. It's the International Trade Data System.
Uh-huh.
And what that is, it's a global customs service system. And they have representatives from each of the departments of government, you know, like the EPA and the Department of Agriculture and all of this. But all of those people are part of the board of directors of this private organization that is the International Trade Data System. So it really gets convoluted in that the U.S. State Department are the ones that oversee the international agreements.
Okay.
So when they redesigned our government into a corporate structure, and then they added in global systems that we were going to hook into, they created this other higher level of governing structure over the top of our domestic government that then, you know, reports to the State Department, and that works at the global level.
Okay, so when they said, if I'm saying the correction of the term, I mean, saying the term correctly, when you had these political leaders saying the reinvention of government, this is what they're talking about?
Yes, and it was kind of a bait and switch thing, because it started out as a national project, and initially I thought that it was done for the healthcare system, but upon further research, it may have actually begun with the smart highway system. Or it could have been a convergence, you know,
mm-hmm.
of just the right time, you know, to be able to do this kind of thing as the internet, the telecommunications backbone of the nation became available to do these kinds of automation of our infrastructure, which would be our highway systems, the smart grid, all of these systems that are outside the boundaries of government, outside the boundaries of corporations. And so you have the convergence of, that's why you have the public-private partnerships, because they basically designed systems to integrate the functions of both together. And there you go. You've got a fascist system.
Well, one of the other things is, okay, so they get the NAFTA. If they would have gotten the NAFTA superhighway in, they already had in line those that have been fighting this thing in Texas, that they had already had most of the other highways in that state online to go into being foreign owned and being made oh, I want to say the term when they charge you to drive down the highway.
Toll roads.
Yeah, toll roads. Mm-hmm. And so that our highway system now becomes toll, and in many more levels. And but you know, luckily Texas and the people down there have been pretty astute in fighting them tooth and nail. And I don't know how many people in this country should are aware of what a valiant efforts they've been putting forth in trying to keep this particular effort on the part of the takeover of our highway systems and the breakup of this country, because they have plans to do that in all the states.
Yes, they do. And the people down in Texas succeeded in saving their property for the moment, but it didn't stop the transportation system from proceeding, and it's being built in pieces in different places.
Right.
And the core in Boise, that you know, where we began this conversation, that is one of the transportation corridors that will link into the Canamex. And the Canamex was actually the first corridor project that was defined in law, going from the Laredo, Texas, the Mexican border in Texas, clear up to the Canadian border.
Well, you know,
and then linking into both the Mexican corridor system and the Canadian corridor system, which is called the Asia-Pacific Gateway. So China basically has us surrounded with this system, the way that it's defined. And now, you know, our governor, Butch Otter, is going over to China to get foreign direct investment to continue building this system.
So not only do they put us into debt, and see, this is why it's so important that a lot of people understand that some of these huge infrastructure projects that they come across with these engineering firms that'll come through the towns and sell them the big stadiums and sell them the big infrastructure projects, school districts, you name it, and put these taxing entities into debt, then that just opens them up for the possibility that, you know, that a lot of the cities and counties and states and whatever being in the position of bankruptcy. And so
right.
They'll end up...
Well, those stadiums are built in the intermodal commerce zones, and that property is taken out of the sales tax, property tax system. So, you know, I'm not sure, you know, unless the city officials make a deal on tickets, but I would bet that the way the deal goes is that something like, well, you know, you give my brother-in-law this concession, and, you know, we'll go along with this. But
well, there's a lot to be paying attention to when these happen, because what there was a book written by John Perkins that Secrets of an Economic Hitman, and it's what various engineering firms would do going down into third world countries, is they would put those people into debt, and then in order to get out of debt, they had to put in jeopardy or give away or for little to nothing their resources, and the infrastructure oftentimes might not even have been served any purpose for those people, but it was sold to those countries or governments, and then the people were put in debt and then taken over by these corporations or, you know.
Right, and that's exactly what they did in Boise. And one of the things that I researched, and it just amazingly coincidental or fate or whatever you want to call it, but a number of years ago, a friend called me and said, you know, this lady that was living in Star, Idaho, which is just west of Boise, I guess, little tiny rural town, wanted to know what was going on, because these builders came in. They were building this huge housing development of 600 homes in Star, and there was no business in Star, no industry. There were no buyers for these homes. And she was really worried about it because, number one, you know, it was ruining their rural way of life. And in number two, you know, how were they going to pay for all of this infrastructure that was necessary for these homes, and, you know, who's going to pay for it and all of this? Well, I researched that, and it was also a very convoluted story. But what it ultimately was and intended to be was that the mayors of the cities within a big, like a 30-mile corridor, they were solicited to start a partnership. They were given a $500,000 grant by the Environmental Protection Agency. They got all this help to basically start a regional organization separate and apart from the underlying governing structure, the elected representative governing structure. And the mission of this higher level regional organization would have been for planning and zoning. And I was just looking at that today, and I'm not sure that they ever were able to get all of the mayors to agree and to sign this intergovernmental agreement. But I think a couple of them did. I think the mayor of Boise did, along with maybe Meridian. But I can't say that for sure at this point because I don't know. But it kind of looks like it, just from the other things that I was looking at.
Well, what we need to be doing here is asking questions. I mean, anytime somebody throws some money around, everybody's ready to jump on board, and they don't ask questions. And in the meantime, I can't tell you how many people I've run into that have trained their own person, foreign person, to take over their job, either here or over in another country. There's a point when it seems like, you know, okay, so it pays the bills for the moment, but when are we going to think beyond that moment? You know,
well, the people that are running our country, you know, they maybe it's these bankster gangsters, you know, that they get countries to reorient their whole policy, to ignore their domestic policy, and to just look outward to the global marketplace for their largest corporations. And in doing that, what they do is they set up their own businesses to be choked off, number one. And secondly, they collapse their own domestic economy. And, you know, once a country has reached that point to where their own domestic economy is collapsing, that's when the vultures move in and they start buying everything up, you know, on the cheap.
Right, and one of the things that's just perplexing the heck out of me right now is to see how quickly the mantra is being stated on how we need to change currencies. Well, who stands to gain when they change currencies? Isn't it a matter of valuation and not just changing it? If they change it, then somebody's really going to get taken to the cleaners.
Well, you know who that is, right?
Right. And the sad part about it is, okay, so we agree to them to take, you know, change the currencies. What do? They do to us like they did to Argentina, and every few, you know, 20, 30 years, they go back in and do it again. Mm-hmm. And so they bankrupt the people, and then they have to start all over again. So
I don't think if they succeed this time, they won't have to go over and do it again. Because they will have a global computer system where they can just, you know, set the value, set the prices of everything. and the economic system will no longer be based on commodities and production. It will be based on conservation, which is a completely upside down and twisted way to look at the world.
However it is, we will end up on the losing end.
No question about it.
Yeah, we will be working for, you know, next to nothing like they've done to many other societies around this world. In fact, when you listen to some of the words of those who are in this leadership, they wanted to bring us down to third world status.
Mm-hmm. Well, when I was researching what was going on in Boise, they did the same kind of thing. It's the pump and dump, you could call it. It's not the stock market, but it's the community pump and dump. And what they do, they pump a lot of money into the community. And what I found is that Goldman Sachs, the Ford Foundation, a whole bunch of corporate donors were pumping money into Boise. You know, and what they do is they create the illusion of an economic boom, and everything looks great, the future looks bright, you know, and when the money's flowing, people aren't looking and they're not thinking, they're just, you know, it's boom time. And then, you know, after these corporations get whatever it is that they want, then they pull out, the money goes with them. And since there is no real underlying economy, it was all a fake, the whole thing kind of collapses, and then they are in deep debt because they've paid for infrastructure for this illusory boom.
Well, it sounds to me like it goes back to the same old era of when they had the mining towns, and they just went from town to town to town doing this sort of thing, and then, you know, the people would move on and just leave, you know, leave. These guys have no problem in that. I mean, I find a real irony in that is because it's a very interesting environmental situation for those who are into the environment, and you watch places like Dubai already experiencing some of that.
Well, I don't believe there really is a real environmental movement in this country anymore. I think it was bought out by the corporations. And, you know, I think they were infiltrated just like all groups are infiltrated, and they were basically taken over by corporate people who have been very clever, you know.
It's become a marketing strategy.
Yes, yeah, it's all about the marketing strategy. And
not that there isn't a very good reason behind a lot of that, but unfortunately the corporations don't view environment, they view a dollar, or view a dollar as the bottom line. So
And what they do is they take advantage of people who really do care about the environment. I care about the environment. You do. Everybody, nobody wants to mess in their own nest, you know. But the corporations have bought out. All you need to do, really, as a strategy, is to just buy out the leadership of an organization. And then you have your Madison Avenue marketing types come up with the propaganda that you need to say as a leader of an environmental organization. And then what you do, you know, can be something entirely different.
Before you know it, they've co-opted the language. Everything is sustainable and green. I mean, you know, things that didn't used to be sustainable and green are now sustainable and green. But who are you sustaining?
Yeah, I think it's kind of a bilious green. The putrid there, you know. Something.
But, so, we've done this. With these foreign trade zones have probably been something by another name in many other countries, and that now it's finally come home to us, because we've probably been involved in a lot of this. Maybe some of it might have been termed as a military base or
They are utilizing the closed military bases in the United States, and they declare those as hub zones. Okay, now That's another interesting aspect of this, is that the businesses that reside in a hub zone can get preferential preference points for government contracting. So what I think they did in Silicon Valley, you know, they bring students in. You know, the university connection in the Trojan Triangles is that they have university students engaged in what actually should be jobs, you know, real paying jobs.
But they're working for nothing?
Right. Yeah,
I know.
It's the students that...
It's the old guild.
Yeah, the graduate students that developed all of this technology for the smart highway, because there was no market for the smart highway technology. And it was not in the interest of the car companies to put so much computer technology in cars that now, you know, you've got to pay $60,000 for a car. So they, you know, came up with this scheme of funding, quote, research and development through these research institutes that are public-private partnerships. You've got corporate money flowing into those and government money under the name of research, and you have the students doing the work. Quite a deal, huh?
Right. Now, there's all kinds of ways that they can get us to work for nothing.
Well, look at me. I used to make really good money, and now I'm using my analytical skills and talents, and I'm doing it for free. I'm doing it for our country, for future generations, and I consider it worth doing. But I don't suppose that our government leaders consider it a benefit for me to do what I do. But but the point is that, you know, I'm working harder now than I ever have, and I'm doing it for free.
Well, one of the things I'm also finding, you know, for those of us that are trying to do, you know, educate the public, or at least get the public to start educating themselves and looking in and ask into these concepts and scenarios and asking questions. I mean, you know, don't take our word for it. You know, start looking into this information, because unless we start asking the questions, you know, they're certainly not going to give us the answers. Because what I find so much, and I know I'm sure you do too, is there's so much revisionist history going on out there. It's a constant battle trying to decipher and discern the bad or incorrect information out there, or history that never happened.
Yeah, that's true. And I guess history is written from a perspective, you know, the perspective of the author. But history is kind of like a kaleidoscope, you know, and so I suppose what they do, I don't know this for a fact, but I suppose what they do is they pick their one line of thinking, and they make all of the history hang off of that one thread. Well, there are a million threads in history, and you could say that one of the threads that I'm documenting, that you could probably bet would not be the selected history that the government would write, is that I'm writing actually the history of automation in our country. Because when they crossed the boundary, when they made the internet available to the public and they made it a backbone for government and corporations to all hang their processes off of the telecommunications background, and then to take that technology, that information system, and begin to automate our infrastructure, we actually entered into a new era of automation, and it's automation of the infrastructure.
And what made you decide that that needed to be written?
Because I needed to find out what was going on in our country. You know, why were they exporting white-collar jobs over to India? Because that violates every tenet of national security. I mean, and it about 65% of our economy at that point was in knowledge jobs, in information, and those white-collar jobs were among the best white-collar middle-class jobs in the country. And so by massively exporting those jobs over to India, it was a given, an absolute certainty that they were going to collapse our economy. Because when you look at job creation, when a job is created in a real economy, there is a multiplier effect to it. That the money that that one person is making gets distributed, a certain percentage of it gets distributed throughout the community and actually throughout the whole country. And I think when I first learned about the multiplier effect, it was like one for three or something, you know, that the amount of money that a job would create, you know, would generate throughout the community had a multiplier effect of about like three. Well, it works in reverse, too. You know, if you pull that money out of the economy, you're pulling it out from the restaurant that the guy used to go to, the dry cleaner that the guy used to go to. He no longer spends as much money in the dry cleaner. He may not go to the movies as much anymore. So you have a negative multiplier throughout the economy for every job that you lose. So if you export millions of your best white-collar jobs over to another country, you're going to collapse your economy. And that's really what they did. And I knew that, you know, when I first saw what they were doing.
Let me put, and I don't know if this is a good equation, but instead of bombing a country and dealing with going in and rebuilding it, which we've seemed to be pretty good at doing these days, this is being done in a much more slow motion version, and so that they're going to redo the infrastructure, they're going to redo the whole system, but just on a much more incremental means, correct?
Yeah, because they have to embed the technology in the infrastructure, which is complete and utter insanity. You collapse your economy at the same time that you want to rebuild everything, incorporating, you know, technology into everything. See, that's why they needed Sintra to have a toll road, because no longer are they just building a road and then they can, you know, go away for 20 years and maybe just resurface it occasionally. No, they've got all that technology there, and they need data. They've got communications systems. They've got computer systems. They've got sensors embedded in there. They've got all of this information technology overhead that they are putting on top of road maintenance. And that overhead is not going away. It is forever. And so that's why they needed to make them toll roads.
So
now you can say, now what benefit is there to you and me? You know, we were perfectly fine with a highway system that was built, and, you know, maybe it gets a little wavy or something, you know, but we're perfectly fine with the highway system as it was. So they weren't doing this, making this super highway for us. I consider that it was basically for military purpose and not.
Well, that's what the Dwight David Eisenhower highway system was for.
Right, but I think it was converted to be not to the benefit of the United States.
Okay, right. So, one interesting thing is when you sit in and you listen to some of these meetings. I mean, because there's meetings going on all over the world all all the time. But if you get wind and you go check out, you know, what took place at some of these meetings, or you know that some of them they put on C-SPAN or whatever, and you listen to them. Not only are they dismantling our country at this point in time, and I know there's other countries that it's happening to as well, because what they're trying to implement, they've got to do on a worldwide basis, and it has to be quite timely, or I think it could blow up in their face. But
and let's hope it does. let me tell you something.
Okay.
I think I figured out why the army is over in the Middle East, and they're never coming back. It's because they've redefined our country to be, you know, this basically international shipping lanes, and which means that it's not really land anymore, and you can't really, you don't really need an army if, you know, your whole system is based on maritime law. And I think that's why they've changed the mission of the Coast Guard.
Well, they've combined a lot of our services too with other countries. I mean, we've combined with Canada in many aspects. And then I was just watching a press conference just recently when you had President Obama and I forgot the name of the person over Canada.
Harper.
Yeah, Harper. They were standing there with their flags behind them. I think there was a symbology taking place there, and I don't know how many people might have picked up on that, but I think they were telling us that, you know, that we were combined in more ways than just one. I mean, when you have our Air Force combined with the Canadian, I think they tried to do that with the Mexican, and I think they got a lot of flack over it, so they might have backed off for the time being. But I don't think that that's, you know, they're going to be included in this because that was part of the North American Union.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah, and the first time that, you know, anybody mentioned to me about that yellow fringe, you know, saying that it was admiralty law, I didn't really take that very seriously. And I did call my senator's office, and they did send me this little write-up on the history of flags. And at this point, I can say that they lied to me. They didn't really tell me the truth about the flags, because I think the yellow fringe does mean exactly what the people said that it meant, which is that it means admiralty law. And so, you know, and it all makes sense now in the context of understanding what they've done with the corridor systems and the inland ports and all of that. So,
well, I'm not sure about, because they get, when you start listening to some of these different people that have studied a lot of this, between your international commercial you have your maritime admiralty and commercial, I get a little lost on it. But all I can say is that when it comes down to it, what's running the world is a commercial venture. And when they even started this country, it was under a commercial venture.
Mm-hmm.
And to think that we ever really drifted away from it, I think was the illusion in the first place.
Well,
I don't know.
I suppose. I mean, I can't. I have
I know
a hard
it's a lot
time.
To fathom.
I mean, I have
that.
A hard time with that. Because I know that what they did with the Washington D.C. district, they did make it a district, and it probably is a port district under maritime law, and that is something that, you know, they never taught us. You know, was never mentioned, neglected to mention it. But I think here, you know, in the interior of the country, I don't think that there were people that were dishonest all throughout history that knew the truth all throughout history. I think that certain truths get buried, and historians and people, you know, they go digging through history and they bring this stuff out eventually, and I think that's what's happening now.
Right. Well, and I'm not saying that you know, I don't disagree there. I'm just saying that you know, you're right. I think that there is that, or it's kind of like, you know, how many of us live in a city that has many, many symbologies and statues and various symbols and think it means one thing and find out when you do a little research that it might have more than one meaning or multiple meanings, and you live among it and don't even notice it and don't even understand why it was even put there until you start looking at, you know, that its purpose. So I think a lot of us have experienced that in our own understanding of our country, and it just goes in one aspect. When I keep hearing over and over and over again, democracy, 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 democracy is never what we were made into, and yet they use that term all the time.
Yeah, and there is a reason for that, and that does have to do with maritime. What the heck is it? The International Maritime Law. And I just found that today, and I don't know if I can find it quickly enough to read this.
And I've never heard it in that context put with the maritime law. I just know that term got somewhere along the line. It was introduced into our vernacular when, you know, that wasn't what we were initially set up as.
Yeah. No, here I found it.
Okay.
When I was doing this research today because of InfoWars had an article about the Mexican military coming onto American soil and searching cars. Well, one of the little tidbits in that article was that the markings on the Mexican military were La Marina. They were the Mexican Navy that were coming in, you know, into our country and searching cars. Well, you know, they're doing the port, the cargo inspection thing.
So the Inland Marine, huh?
Yeah. Okay. And so as I was thinking about this, I remembered the term ship of state. And so I looked up ship of state, and what that is, it's a metaphor that was in Plato's book, what is that, six of Plato's Republic.
Okay.
Okay, now, this is interesting. I'll read this to you, okay? The use of the metaphor. Plato establishes the comparison by describing the steering of a ship as just like any other craft or profession, in particular, that of a politician. He then runs the metaphor in reference to a particular type of government, democracy. Plato's democracy is not the modern notion of a mix of democracy and republicanism, but rather pure rule by what he terms the poor masses by way of pure majority rule. Plato argues that the masses are too busy fighting over what they consider to be the right of way to steer the ship to listen to the true navigator. So that's where it comes from. I mean, even that, you know, the whole switch over to pure democracy. But ultimately, okay, quoting again, it is ultimately seen then that the ship of state metaphor is a cautionary tale against rule by anything other than an enlightened, benevolent monarch of sorts. So he's making a case, you know, for a monarch that would have subjects that, you know, he cares about. And where does all this whole international maritime stuff comes from the city of London.
And how so? I mean,
how so?
Mm-hmm.
That's where the International Maritime Organization is.
Okay, all right.
And the East India Trading Company, and I think it was probably the British who you know wrote the Law of the Sea, and not the Law of the Sea Treaty, but who initially defined maritime law.
Okay, it's been a while since I've read up on some of that, but some of these subjects.
I don't know that for a fact, but it certainly uh-huh. does all fit together in the scenario that I see.
Uh-huh. Well, when you start getting into any of this, it can reach so far and broad and wide that sometimes you just kind of go, "Oh my goodness, I was." It's just like I said, you know, when it really comes down to it, don't take our word for it. Start looking into this yourself, and start, you know, doing the work. You know, I mean, it sometimes it seems like it's overwhelming, and in a lot of ways it is. But at the same time, you know, it's quite interesting as well. I mean, when you start finding out why you do things, I mean, there's usually a reason for everything, and even though oftentimes they say, well, they just do it just because. Well, no, there isn't a just because there is a because. You know, I mean, there is a reason why we have picked up and do things the way we do things. And
they're not going to tell us. And I, you know, I feel for anybody who really wants to pick up on this Trojan Triangle system, but if people want to read about it, you know, I've gone halfway there for you. I've put it all together for you.
Yeah, you do have a great website with a lot of great information
mm-hmm.
on channelingreality.com.
And so. You know, if anybody wants to read that, it's, you know, halfway there for you. Still won't be easy, you know, because there are so many pieces to this thing that it's a little bit difficult. But, yeah, I've got, you know, probably five or six major pieces of documentation of my research that I've put together, you know, for people to read about it if they want to.
You know, I mean, and again, it comes back, you know, you have people talk about conspiracy, but I, you know, the way I look at it is you got a bunch of people and that are control freaks. And if you've ever studied a control freak, they don't leave anything untouched. And that's what's going on in our world, is there is nothing that is untouched by the control freaks.
Yeah.
And so once you start looking in at any aspect of our lives, somebody's controlling that situation.
Yeah. Well, if they're doing something that affects my life and they didn't tell me in very straightforward terms, I consider that to be dishonest. And I consider it a threat, you know, because they're doing something. If they're not straightforward and honest about it, then they're hiding something. And, you know, whether people want to term that as a conspiracy theory, if I dig out the information and I present it as if these are things that we should have been told, but they didn't tell us, then, you know, so be it. Call me a conspiracy theorist, but I can show you why I'm saying it, and I can show you the laws that they, you know, I can show you everything that they did. And if you can tell me that it's not a conspiracy, then okay, you know, I'll accept that.
No, I think what you're doing is showing the conspiracy fact.
Mm-hmm.
It isn't just a theory anymore. You know, I think that terminology is there to divert us away from digging further. And for those of us that have bothered to say, I'm not accepting that, I'm going to look further because I know there's a reason why. And people, you know, people just don't. Yeah, there's a lot of people that are lemmings or just sheeple. But ultimately, those of us that question and do start digging and looking for the reasons for, we find reasons.
Yeah. Well, I call dissolving our nation and putting us under international law, I call that a conspiracy, and I call it treason. And I don't buy this. It's just business.
Well, they'll tell us anything they think we will accept or want to hear. But in the meantime, this is what, you know, we've been able to uncover up to this point, and I'm sure there's much more to the story. But in the meantime, I'm going to have to thank you, Vicki, for coming on and giving the information on some of your latest research, and that people start being aware that, you know, there's more to it than meets the eye. If there's money being thrown around somewhere, there's usually it's gotten to the point where I start looking why. Because in other ways, it's pulled away from us in so many ways and told us why we can't have money or why it's not available or whatever. Then I have to ask questions in that direction, and I have to ask questions in the other direction, because we've been, you know, told so many stories up to this point. You know, I don't trust it. You know, I have to look and know for myself.
Yeah, I agree with you. I don't trust anything that this government, the people in this government, I don't trust anything that they say at this point.
Well, you know, and I have to say that when I start looking at history, I have to start questioning a lot of that there too, because a lot of what has been happening now didn't start today. It was by design years and centuries before this came about. These people like to plan things a long time in advance, and they love their little utopian societies or supposed utopian societies or scenarios to get us to sign on to whatever their little scenario is, and often it, you know, we're let off a cliff, but you know, we wouldn't be if we started questioning. You agree, Vicki?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, we definitely have to do something, and it can't be such that people have to basically fight on all fronts. It can't be gang warfare against the individual as it is now, because if that system is allowed to continue, people will just shrivel up and not participate at all, because you can't fight a 360-degree battle where they're coming at you at all sides.
Right, and so...
not possible.
Right, but... And I don't know the answers, but I know that I'm looking for them, and I find little, you know, some of the answers in some places, and it's just a matter of everybody start doing something, and it may just overwhelm those that have thought that, you know, we were going to sit back and be complacent. So.
Yeah, I don't know how to do that.
You mean be complacent?
Yeah.
Well, again, I want to thank you, Vicki, and say good night, and we'll have music coming up next.
Okay, well, thank you for having me, Melody.
Good night.
Good night.